All right. So now let's talk a little bit about apocalyptic. And let me hear from you first. Let's think first, just, you know, in the general culture, because this is a word that gets used in the general culture, right? In fact, like you find it when you look up descriptions for movies or television shows. Do you see this word in there sometimes, right? So tell me what are some ways when ordinary people in our world today hear the word apocalyptic, what do they have in mind? Somebody over here. Apocalyptic, what would it mean? Yes. End of the world. Yes. Somebody else? Zombies. Sorry, zombies. Yes. What else? Somebody, if you throw up your hand, I'll be able to listen to you. No, you say them. Yeah, Becky.
Destruction.
That's good. All right. So apocalyptic is, in a sense, is a word we're familiar with. And I think especially this end of the world, destruction and zombies even. Yeah. All right. So the big question is how does that relate to this word that we're using? And that is actually in the text. So let's look up these passages. And maybe I need my Bible up here too. Okay. So let me get my Bible. All right. Someone, will you do this? Will you read Revelation 1 for us? What do you see there? Real loud. All right, so you're thinking, I don't see the word apocalyptic in there. Well, this word is translated right here, Revelation. So there's the word. This is the apocalypsis. If we were in Greek, if you were reading this in Greek, you would see the apocalypsis of Jesus Christ. Now, I think what helps us understand what's being said here in Revelation is to look at some of these other uses. Anybody happen to already have Matthew 11 that could read it for us? What have you got, Becky? Can you guess what word in there is apocalypsis? So there's something that's hidden, and it's being revealed. All right. Somebody else? Matthew 16 and 17. Yes, Tina? So there's something he didn't know or understand, and it was what? Revealed to him. All right, let's do one more. Galatians 1, 12 and 16. All right, Gwen.
For I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. And in 16, we'll start from the middle, was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles.
All right, so these are other uses of this word apocalypse. So somebody tell me how does that contrast, or how does that help you get a sense of what this word is all about?
It's like something hidden, being made known.
By whom?
The one who knows.
Yeah, yeah. It was not revealed to you by any man, but by God himself. So there's a sense in which this apocalypse, it's God revealing something. Now, I just want you to think with me for a minute about maybe how you have thought about the book of Revelation. Have you thought about this book as something that's going to make something hidden clear, that's going to uncover something, that's going to reveal something to you? No? But I hope that that's actually a first step of encouragement for you to realize here this word, it means uncovering something, revealing something. It was written not to make something more complicated, not to hide the truth in something that we can't decipher, which is, I think, how we feel about Revelation sometimes, don't we? Like, can't you just say it straight out so I don't have to try to decipher and interpret this? But actually, this book wasn't written to make it difficult for us to understand something. It was actually written to uncover, to reveal something that only God can reveal to us. And that's what's happening here in this book of Revelation. All right. Somebody throw up a hand and tell me another place we would read what we would call, because, okay, so we've talked about apocalypse, this revelation of God revealing something that has been hidden that now we are to know. But then we're talking about apocalyptic literature, which would be literature that uses this text type in it. So in addition to Revelation, where do we read some things that we think that kind of sounds like uniquely, kind of like some of the stuff in Revelation that's an apocalyptic, like it sounds? You know, somewhere, is there some, Charlotte? Ezekiel has some of that. Why do you say Ezekiel? Like, give me an example of something Ezekiel that makes you say that.
Wheels,
so you've got this strange creatures and, yeah, and you think, okay, this probably means something. I got to figure that out, right? Yes? What did you think? Green sweater. I forgot your name. Yep.
Sharonda. I was thinking about the second half of Daniel and the
yes.
statue and the bronze and all of those.
Yes. And so what makes you think of that as being, why do you connect that to apocalyptic? Mm-hmm. And if you think about Daniel, what is it telling us about? What are those things conveying? Do you have a sense of that? That was a harder question to throw at you.
Yeah, well, it has to do with events that will take place.
In the future. We keep seeing that in Daniel. If you look back in Daniel 2, you get these exact words we were just reading in the New Testament. Something that was hidden that's going to be revealed. Mysteries are going to be revealed to him. All right, so we've got Ezekiel, Daniel, other ideas? What do you think?
Isaiah,
why do you say that?
There's a lot of prophecy in it that is not yet fulfilled.
Yeah, things he says that is not yet fulfilled. He looks very far in the future. But he also, think about Isaiah 6. What happens in Isaiah 6? He's like, you know, in the year Uzziah died, I saw, he sees the Lord seated on the throne. Does that sound anything like Revelation? Kind of does, doesn't it? Is there any other place in the New Testament we might hear some apocalyptic? Susan?
Well,
what else were you going to say?
I was going to say Joel, but if you're
yes.
the Pentecost, where you're reflecting back on
the same. Okay, on that Joel prophecy there? Okay, like it. What do you think?
Matthew.
And it's Susan, right?
Matthew.
Where in Matthew? The Olivet Discourse, which Jesus is talking about what there? And you get an A+ if you get this because you got it all figured out, right? Yeah.
Well, he does start talking about like the kingdom's already here, but then what's to come.
He's certainly talking about the future, right? In some ways that sound kind of revelation-y. Yeah, Heather.
Second Peter.
Okay. Yeah. What in Second Peter? I hadn't thought of that one. Yep. And what's good? And the earth is being destructed there, right, by fire? All right, exactly. So there are different pockets, maybe not whole books, but there are sections of books that use this same type of thing that sounds end of the world-ish and destruction-ish and judgment-ish, right? Kind of like we expect from apocalyptic literature. There's actually more apocalyptic literature outside the canon of the Bible. So if, you know, if we had some biblical scholars here, you know, some of them would be raising their hand and they'd list off, I don't know what the names of some of these extra biblical books are, but that use the same type of techniques and imagery. In fact, so we're talking about the kind of things that they share. So what are some of the traits of apocalyptic? All right, Somebody give me a trait. We've said some of them. Let me just write down the ones we had first, right? We've said end of the world. And we said destruction, I think. I'm not going to put zombies because I'm not sure I can see zombies. But yeah, what did you have? Okay. How shall we say that? How about if we say it's a series of visions? A series of visions, not necessarily chronological, right? Somebody else? A lot of use of symbols, yes. What else? Numbers, interesting use of numbers, right? And in some ways, that's kind of connected to symbols, isn't it? Maybe numbers get used symbolically, maybe not in other places. What else would be something unique to, not necessarily unique to, but a marker of apocalyptic literature? Yeah. Yeah, so metaphors, is that a metaphor? I always get those confused. That's a simile? Like is a simile? All right. Similes, so we'll say both, right? Did I spell them right? I don't know if I did. I'm not a good speller. That wasn't in my bio. Okay. I think we've covered most of them. I'm going to add two more. What have you got? Prophecy, that's important, yes. Yes, I'm going to call them prophetic, right? How about this? How about bizarre creatures? Did you see a few of those? I didn't spell that right either. Okay, and then I'm going to also say angels and what else? Demons, yeah. All right, so these are marks of apocalyptic literature. All right, so you're at a table with someone. I want you to turn to the person at your table, and I want you to just talk a little bit about these things. If you've already been teaching the Bible, maybe you write about it, maybe you lead small groups, and you haven't done this yet, why would you not want to maybe or haven't yet chosen Revelation for what you're going to study or lead on? You know, why does it intimidate us? And what was your experience in deciding whether or not to sign up for this workshop in regard to apocalyptic? All right. So don't go on and on, first person, because you don't want me to cut off the time before you let the other person talk. So I'm going to give you about 3 minutes. You guys talk about that with each other. Okay. Now we're going to let, I want to invite a few of you to share this with the group. All right. So give me some reasons why we're thinking, oh, man, all these things I could teach, I don't think I'll teach Revelation. What are some reasons maybe we avoid Revelation?
It's too confusing.
It's confusing, right? And by saying that, Could I draw out from that we're afraid we won't be able to understand it? Ooh, we're afraid we won't understand it. We'll get it wrong. Yeah. It's controversial. Like, in the days of COVID and race issues, you really want to dive into Revelation? And, we might be a little bit afraid of controversy. We know there's a lot of disagreement about it. What else?
I feel unprepared in my theological framework because I grew up in a certain very adamant one. And only in the last few years have I realized, oh, that's not the only way to look at that book. And suddenly I feel overwhelmed.
You use the word framework. We've got a lot of people who haven't been to a seminary and trust. Maybe you've been to one before, and maybe one of the instructional sections was actually about framework, but maybe you haven't been here before. So, Susan, tell us what you mean by framework.
Okay, I just mean that I grew up in a church where it was like, this is all literal, and this is the dispensation of the whatever. And so I thought there was only one way, it's the way I heard it preached as a kid. And all of a sudden, in the last few years, I've realized that some people see it as almost completely symbolic, or some people see parts of it this and that, and all of a sudden it just opened to this why, oh, there's a lot of different ways you could look at some of this stuff, and then suddenly I feel like, then I don't know what to do.
Right. So, we all have frameworks. What we mean by this, a way we think things are and ought to be, right? And so there might be lots of different kind of frameworks we would bring to different kinds of texts. Probably in regard to apocalyptic literature and specifically Revelation, you're talking about an interpretive framework. You mentioned dispensational might be one, and there would be some others, whether we read it, we think this is all about the future, or this is all about something that happened in 70 AD. And so, but what we're talking about is, and it's a little bit tricky with Revelation, because there is a sense in which you do have to make some interpretive decisions as you work through Revelation. But the underlying question is, where are you getting it from, right? Did you just inherit it, and when you read the what's in the text, you work really hard to make it fit into that framework? Or is your framework always, in a sense, being tested by or challenged by what you're reading, right? Where's the authority? Is the authority in my framework, and I must make the text fix my framework? Or is the authority in, here's what the scripture is, so maybe I better try to figure out if my framework is worthwhile or not, right? So that's one of the big challenges of Revelation. All right. And I think the thing is, we're going to have, the thing about frameworks, they aren't necessarily wrong or bad, right? Because we're going to automatically have frameworks. The question about frameworks is, am I aware enough of my framework to see that when I'm looking at a text, I am trying to force the text into that rather than letting the text speak to my framework? All right. Another reason we avoid Revelation. Yes. It's going to be hard. Yeah. That's kind of like confusing, but it's slightly different, right? What have you found, by the way, about hard things you've done in your life? Why? Maybe that will happen to us. We've invested ourselves in doing something hard. I mean, some of us, our brains have atrophied. Like, we haven't had to study this hard since we were in high school or college, right? And you're like, I forgot how to do this, right? And I forgot how to build a case and present it to people. And you know what? This is going to be good for us, all right? Hard can be good. Hard can be good. All right. Anything else? You got one? And even the way it's organized, and it's not simple in some ways, right? It can be overwhelming because we're going to have different types of literature, and we're going to have an image on top of an image on top of an image, and we got to figure out how it's organized to make sense of it. I think overwhelming is good. Another one, yeah? Why emotional?
Well, kind of both ends of the spectrum. Like, you know, you start out at the beginning and you're just like in awe and you're ready to worship the messenger, kind of like John did, like, this is so good, I have to just give you a hug or something. And then it gets to the parts that just break your heart.
Yeah.
It's going to be the polar opposite of that, of eternal.
Now, what I think is interesting about emotional is that, I mean, some people think women just will love something that's emotional because we're all emotion, right? And we're here to prove otherwise. We're going to apply our heads to this, right? But we do love it that it gets to the heart, don't we? I mean, it can be intimidating, but we love it that it gets to the heart. All right, let me mention one other reason I think that we avoid revelation, and that it is perhaps all about, we think it's all about the future and nothing about today. Or another way to say that might be, maybe we think it's not practical. And we've gotten so used to this in our Bible studies, right? We feel like people want to study something that's going to say, okay, so I'm going to walk out, so I'm going to add this to my to-do list. And we think that it is not going to be practical. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it would make any sense for John to address a letter to seven churches in the first century that was mostly about things that only the generation who is alive at the return of Christ would need to know? And doesn't it make more sense that John wrote to believers in his day as well as believers in every era in between his day and the day of Christ's return about what they need to know and how they're supposed to live and what they're supposed to value and how they're going to cope with harsh realities of living life in this world? Revelation, actually, we're going to see it covers the whole scope of redemptive history, going way back to Christ's eternality and through his life, death, and resurrection, and his ascension, and his present reign, and his coming again in the consummation, and his eternal reign. It's going to cover the whole gamut. It's not solely about the return of Christ. That's how, what we can really think that about Revelation, right? That might even be a framework, yikes, that we might bring to it. So we can have our eyes open for that. All right. Yes. Quickly, I'm already behind. Yeah, I think that's a great one. I'm glad you added that. All right. What'd you say? Okay, don't be done. I'm going to have more for you. All right. So there's just some reasons that we would avoid Revelation. And if we think it is all about the future and has nothing for us today, this is, you don't have to try to draw this because I believe this is in your workbook. What page is it on, Lydia? What? It's like the fourth page? All right, you'll see this there. It's already room for you. This, I have to tell you, when I think about Simeon Truss, nothing has changed my life more than this diagram right here. So it might just seem like this is a bunch of diagrams, right? I got to tell you, I use this all the time when people are asking me how to interpret, you know, how do you get to the certain meaning of a scripture? So I'm going to walk through it quickly, and maybe Cindy's going to come back to it, so I'm not going to take too much time. But we start with our text, right? So here's our text we've got. And think about most of the Bible studies you've been in. Or they read the text, and what's the next question? The next question is, what does this mean to me? Right? So they go right from the text to what? To the audience and application. And you know what that means? That means sometimes our application is way off. All right? But what do we want to do instead? We want to really examine the text, and what are we looking for? What's our first thing we're looking for? We're trying to figure out, what did this mean for the first audience? So who did Moses write the Pentateuch for? Who would be the first audience? Children of Israel who are walking through the desert and entering in the promised land, right? And so who was the first audience for Revelation? These seven churches who lived when? In the first century, all right? Here's the thing. We are never going to come up with it's the meaning for today without going here first. Or we could come up with a meaning but probably be off. It's never going to mean something wholly different for us. There are going to be some differing implications. It's never going to mean something wholly different. And wholly, I'm saying W-H-O-L-L-Y. Wholly different than what it meant for the first audience. So this is our first step. What did it mean to them? All right. But then we don't want to go just from that, because maybe like you're reading the Old Testament, you read, don't wear mixed fibers. And so we're not going to go then immediately to what that means to apply that to us. We have to stop somewhere else first. You see it in this corner? We've got to stop at the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. What difference does Jesus' life, death, and resurrection make in how I'm then going to apply that to my audience today? So I think this really helps us in Revelation, because it's going to save us from reading something and making it immediately about today, because we're really going to be focusing on that first audience. What did this mean for them? And there's actually letters to, you know, these individual messages to the first audience there. We're going to learn a lot about them. And we're going to think about the difference that the death resurrection of Jesus makes. And then we're going to finally get, so what does this mean for us today? Because we're still in a situation of awaiting Christ's return. So this is going to help us. All right, so I'm going to give you some reasons I think that we should teach Revelation. All right, so here's my first one. We talked about confusion and that it's hard. I contend to you, we can understand. What can we understand about it? It's central message. You know what? There's going to be a lot of things in Revelation that in our groups, I tell you what, you're going to get really tempted. Like, we can't move on from this until we figure out exactly what this means, which is not the goal of our small groups, by the way. The goal of our small groups is to help each other move our word work forward. But while we might not be able to understand what every little thing means, we can understand its central message. And as I've studied Revelation, what's become clear to me, like when I first started studying it, I thought the hardest thing about this is going to be to understand it. Now I think the hardest thing about Revelation is to live it, to live in light of it. It's a really challenging call to suffering in obedience to Christ. It's a challenging call to refuse to compromise with the world's systems. That's what's hard. That's a lot harder than understanding it. See, I already got the central message. It was challenging me in regard to those things. All right, so next, we need to see the world from heaven's perspective. You and I, we have a very limited purview on reality with what we can see with our eyes around us. And for us, what we take in on the television and as we scroll on social media and what other people talk about. And we can assume that is all, that is reality, what our senses have the ability to take in. And what does Revelation do? Here's John, and he's given this series of visions that enable him to see the reality of this world, not from an earthly perspective, but from heaven's perspective. And see, from heaven's perspective, it's being revealed to him, this is true reality. This is a revelation of hidden things so that he can see a fuller picture of reality. Some things are being revealed to him that he can't see with human eyes, but they are just as real as things he can see with his human eyes. And you and I need that too, because we can't see these things with our human eyes. He might look at all the things, the glittery things, the world is presenting and say, wow, those look desirable. They look beautiful. And Revelation is going to show, no, those are going to kill you. They're actually ugly, right? We look at the persecution of believers and we think this is tragic. This is a disaster. And Revelation is going to say, no. This is victorious. This is an overcomer, right? So it's changing us, giving us heaven's perspective on those things. All right, third reason I think we need to teach it is because we want its promised blessing. Look with me in Revelation 1:3. 1:3 says, it's right at the beginning, blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. So that is the first of seven, blessed are those. And we knew there were Beatitudes in the Gospel of Matthew. You know, there's Beatitudes in the book of Revelation. There are seven blessed statements. So there's the first one. Look with me at the last one in it's the second to last, I think. Revelation 22:7. It reads, Jesus is speaking, and behold, I am coming soon. Blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book. So you hear it read, beginning and end, and throughout the whole book is this promise of blessing. And I remember when I was first asked to teach Revelation about 15 years ago, I was like looking for an excuse to say no. Right? I thought, well, I should probably read it before I say no. And I get to the third verse. Blessed are those who read and those who hear and keep what is written in this book. And is there ever a blessing we want to say, you know, it's nice you offer that blessing. I don't need that. No. We want all of the blessing he has for us now and into eternity future. And that is the promise of this book. And reading this book uniquely and studying it, trying to understand it uniquely delivers this blessing to us. And then finally, I'd say we need to live out of the story that Revelation tells. Whether you know it or not, you live out of the story that you believe is true. And so the story that gets handed to our kids on all those Disney videos that we show them is the aim of your life is to live happily forever after. So if you think that is the story my life must conform to, what happens when disaster strikes? All right. A story our culture feeds us is the American dream. You can have it all. You can do anything you want to do, right? And these are stories the world, well, actually, we want to live out of another story. And the story we want to live out of is called the Kingdom of God. And because we believe that story is real and compelling, but how are we going to live out of that story if we don't gaze at the King? And if we don't see what life is like in the kingdom and where this kingdom is headed? All right, so hopefully I've convinced you that we need to read the book of Revelation. So I'm going to give you some things I think we need if we're going to study and teach Revelation. The first thing is we need to develop our skills in interpreting symbols. We've talked about this. It has a lot of symbols. What is a symbol? A symbol is a description of a physical object or phenomena that actually represents something else. So what would be some examples of symbols in... let's think about symbols in other parts of the Bible. How about Exodus 19:4? It says, I bore you on eagle's wings. Does it mean he put the whole nation of Israel on an eagle? No. So he's using a symbol to communicate what? Yeah, this divine intervention and this ushering to safety by his mighty power, right? Or how about Jesus uses lots of symbolic language to explain who he is and what he's come to do in the book of John. Remember all of these? I am the what? Good Shepherd. I am the vine, the door, all these things, right? So when he says, I am the door, he's not a door, right? It's symbolism to say something about, you know, I'm the way you enter into this life with God. You don't come in any other way with me, right? So actually, we think of how much symbolism is in Revelation, but actually, if we've been reading the Bible, there's been a lot of symbolism all the way through it. In Revelation, sometimes we're told exactly what the symbol is. For example, in chapter 1, we're told what lampstands are. It says straight out, lampstands are what? And it tells us straight out, white linen represents what? Righteous acts of the saints. And it tells us that the ancient serpent is Satan or the devil. Exactly. So some of them they're told straight out. And others of them we have to interpret. And some of them present actually kind of challenging, complex realities. For example, when you read about Babylon, we read about Babylon, right? And we instinctively know this is a symbol. He's not talking about an actual city in his day of Babylon. So we've got to try to figure out what does that mean? And we discover, okay, Babylon is a symbol of worldly idolatry, materialism, and immorality. The sea is not just the sea, right? The sea represents a place of chaos, evil, danger. Colors and numbers, as we mentioned, have symbolic meaning. And they very much oftentimes represent the sovereignty of God over history. When he says it's going to last this long, how can he say that? Because he's in charge of history. And it's going to last exactly as long as he intends, which is oftentimes what is being communicated. So now as we talk about symbolism, we recognize, as Susan mentioned, that we might come into this workshop with varying degrees or perspectives about symbolism. Some of us come in and our approach for a lot of our life and what we have always heard taught is that whenever we are in the Bible, including Revelation, we want to read it as literally as possible, except where we can't, where it's just so obviously a symbol, all right? So we might lean a little further in that direction, because I think even if you are committed to taking the Bible literally, in Revelation you're going to see some symbols, right? Some things that you're going to interpret that way. Or some of us might lean to a little further, and we just think, okay, this is a book of symbols. And so actually, we should assume some of these things are symbols, unless it seems clear to us we should take it literally. All right. So you may have the same question about this workshop that I had about this workshop, which was like, are we taking a stand on that? Right. No, we're not. All right. We respect the fact that there are differing views on that. And what we're going to try to get you to do is provide provide some support for why you would, if you want to get real argumentative about that, and we're not going to do that in our groups either, right? Support it with scripture in terms of how you wanted to interpret those things. But know that certainly, no matter where we are on that spectrum, there are certainly some things in Revelation that are, we know in our gut that they're communicating something. For example, when we read about the lamb who has been slain, do we think he's talking about a lamb that looks like it was slain? It's talking about what? And what about Jesus? It's about his sacrificial death, right? Or when we read about the lamb on the throne, is he actually seeing a lamb on a throne? I don't know if that's exactly what he sees, but he is using that to speak about what about Jesus? His sovereign authority, right? He is on a throne. When he speaks about a beast, we've got to try to figure out what that symbol is, right? Something about the nature or intentions of Rome in his day, and perhaps the state that is opposed to God in every part of history. When he describes a dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, he's communicating something to us about the terrifying power of Satan himself. All right, so what are some strategies for interpreting symbols? Anybody have any ideas? What do you mean by that? Yeah, we're going to find over and over again, especially John. I think of John like he's sitting there writing Revelation, and he's got the scrolls of Ezekiel and Daniel and Isaiah and Zephaniah and Joel. He's got them right there, right? And so we're gonna, and so when he writes something, we mean, ooh, has that been, and that is going to guide our interpretation of him, because we know that he is drawing from these earlier books in the Bible. The other thing we have to think about, remember that, go back to that first audience. Let's also think about what would that symbol have meant to the first audience, because we want that to guide our understanding. Secondly, we want to look and listen for Old Testament imagery and allusions. Most places in the New Testament, it quotes the Old Testament, and it's like set off. You can think about places in the New Testament, right, where, you know, they'll say, you know, the prophet Isaiah said, or whatever, you know, or it was written, and it's kind of set off because it's a quote. I don't know if you noticed this as you went through Revelation. There weren't a lot of things set off as quotes, and yet when you read them, you thought, okay, I've heard this before, right? So we'll call those allusions, right? You look at them and you think, okay, this comes from somewhere else in the Bible. And he's also using imagery from the Old Testament, like, for example, locusts. You know, as we think about locusts, what, are we going to look in the newspaper to try to figure out what locusts are in our day? Or are we going to say, where has this been used before? And then we get to the book of Joel and Amos, and we see, oh, what are these locusts? Oh, that's describing what the invading armies of Babylon, their impact on Israel when they swept in. And it was like a swarm of locusts had come down and just buzzed everything down, all right? So where are we getting that from? We're, because of an Old Testament allusion. All right, we need to be motivated to grasp and emphasize what is clear. This might be the most important tool that we're going to need for studying and teaching Revelation. Because I don't know about you, there's a lot of things you could get hung up on. And a lot of times as teachers, we feel like we've got to be ready to answer every question. And we read the passage and we know what everybody's going to put their hand up and ask, well, what's this? And that's terrifying. It is for me. I'm not the only one, right? And the thing is, we might not be able to be adamant about a lot of those things. But we can, remember this was number one I started with, we can understand the clear message of Revelation. Revelation wasn't written for scholars. It was written for ordinary people in the first century church. Do you think John was expecting that only a couple people, the really smart ones, would get it? No. He wrote it believing these ordinary believers spread around Asia Minor in the first century, when they read it, they would see its pictures that he's presenting, and they would get the central message. And that's your job as a teacher. You can, and you know what? That enables you to ignore some of the things that are going to be controversial. Not that you don't have to, in your preparation work, try to figure some things out and where you stand on them. But I think you're going to find again and again, those won't be at the heart of the main point of your text. Because you can understand the clear message, and so that it, you'll be able to emphasize that. And so you need to increasingly become motivated to grasp and emphasize what is clear. You're not going to emphasize, it's easy to go into something like this and think, oh, people are going to ask me about this, and they're going to ask me about this, so that's what I'll talk about. No. We're going to emphasize what is clear. And as I said earlier, what is clear is incredibly challenging, right? It's actually easier to talk about some of the controversial stuff because it doesn't demand anything of us, right? But what's clear demands a lot from us in terms of how we're going to live. All right. All right, so, yeah, we want our aim as we approach the text is to uncover the Holy Spirit intended message and meaning of the text, first for who? The first audience, right? And then put that at the center of our message. We don't want to look at a text and say, I could talk about this and I could talk about it. No, we look at the passage and we say, what's the Holy Spirit intended message for that first audience? What difference does the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus made about? These things we want these things to control what we then communicate and teach from the passage. Number four, my final one, is we need to have a sense of how the book is organized. And that's really just a pitch for you to come back tomorrow, because our first session tomorrow morning, we are going to talk about structure. We'll look a little bit about the macro structure of Revelation, which I think is important for us to know before we dive into it, as well as then how we find structure in smaller passages. So understanding and teaching apocalyptic literature is going to require that we develop some new skills and instincts from the text. You know, if I'd probably another answer to why we're nervous about teaching Revelation is, couldn't it be, I know it's going to demand some skills from me that I just have never developed. I don't know how to, you know, narrative, you got me. I love a story, right? Poetry, I like poetry. I can probably figure that out, those imagery in poetry. Discourse, I can trace the audience. I'm good. And then we say apocalypse. We go, oh, boy, you know, I those strange creatures and understand the organs, those things are going to be too challenging for me. So we're going to have to develop our skills. That's why we're here. And we may not leave being experts on apocalyptic literature, but we're going to take a step forward. We're going to be better at it than we would have been before we were here. Because Revelation uniquely provides us a heavenly perspective on life in this world. In what time period? In the time period between the ascension and the return of Jesus. And that is a perspective that we need. And so rather than letting Revelation intimidate us, let's let it motivate us to grasp what is clear and allow that clear message to shape our thinking and our feeling and our words and our worship.